This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have something for you to think about as you do your holiday shopping. It's the story of why a lot of established American department stores are now bankrupt. More specifically, it's the story of Robert Campo, the Canadian real estate developer who bought two chains of American department stores in the mid-80s. His holdings included Bloomingdale's, Brooks Brothers, Jordan Marsh, Filene's, and Ann Taylor. His hostile takeovers were financed with junk bonds. By January 1990, his two chains were in Chapter 11. The Campo deals brought lots of business to the bankruptcy courts, but it's been bad news for American retail. About 8,000 people lost their jobs, and 50,000 creditors filed approximately $8.2 billion in claims. My guest, John Rothschild, is the author of the new book, Going for Broke, How Robert Campo Bankrupted the Retail Industry, Jolted the Junk Bond Market, and Brought the Booming 80s to a Crashing Halt. I asked Rothschild why Campo wanted to get into retail when he knew nothing about it.
Well, I think he wanted to get into almost anything. I mean, it seemed that he wasn't satisfied with being a real estate developer. He was from an area called Sudbury, and apparently there was a regional aspect to it. And I think some people regarded him as a bit of a yokel, even though he'd sort of come up through Ottawa, built a lot of buildings there in the government center, and then went on to Toronto and sort of made his mark on the skyline of all of these cities. But it seems that it wasn't enough. He felt he hadn't gotten enough respect. And he started this sort of odd business of looking at takeovers in all directions in Canada to start out with. He looked at trust companies. He looked at broadcasting companies. He looked at tiny companies that made things like cardboard houses. And he was sort of flying off in a dozen different directions. And the people around him sort of tried to rein him in. And in Canada, he seemed to be fairly successfully reined in and kept in real estate, which he understood.
Well, what exactly did he want? He just wanted to take over anything?
I think he just wanted to be thought of as more important than just a real estate developer. And throughout this story, the theme develops that he would always comment on world politics or on oil prices or on what's happening in the Soviet Union. And I think he really wanted to be the U.S. Secretary of State or something. And I think he wanted to be thought of as very important and invited to all the right parties, and especially in America. So I think the takeover for him was a vehicle toward some kind of self-esteem as opposed to just money.
So why Allied, the department store conglomerate?
Well, there's a sort of funny story. He was looking at a savings and loan in his search for taking over something, and he was looking at an American bank, and he was talked out of the bank, and the savings and loan, the investment bank Shearson, had come up to Canada and he engaged them to search for a savings and loan. They found one in California. They tried to get back to Bob Campo, but he was off having a facelift. He always had other priorities besides his business. The sideshow in this story is his self-improvement, his flying around getting injections for longevity and facelifts and having people following him squeezing fresh orange juice every 15 minutes because he didn't trust it if it was older than 15 minutes. And so he sort of had a designated orange juice squeezer for a time following him around. But anyway, so because he was off having this facelift, the savings and loan deal fell apart. And the people in Canada who were helping him do these things, contact banks, try to find companies to take over, were getting sort of tired of him. And they sent him off to a rather obscure investment advisor in New York, a place called Tribco Partners. And the fellow at Tribco Partners had a friend in Allied Stores. And his thought was maybe Bob Campo, being in real estate, might buy a couple of shopping centers out of this huge company called Allied Stores, which owned, among other things, Brooks Brothers and Ann Taylor. And when he first brought it up with Campo, he said, what's that? He hadn't heard of Allied Stores. So here's a company that he didn't know anything about, and then 8 months later he owned the company. Sort of the most bizarre story, I think, in the 80s financial history.
Well, there's something very frightening about this story, that somebody who knows absolutely nothing about retail, but who wants to improve himself and his reputation, should buy all these, you know, great American department stores and have no idea what to do with them.
Right. I guess from a Horatio Alger point of view, it's sort of inspiring. But for the corporate culture or the economy, it is kind of frightening. I mean, here was this guy who, you know, knew nothing about retailing, and also his management style was a bit unstable. And, you know, so here, all you know, I don't think he could have gotten a job at Allied Store in the management, certainly.
Because he wouldn't have known enough.
Right, he wouldn't have known enough, and also he was, quite frankly, a little strange. But all of a sudden, you know, he probably couldn't get a job there, but he owned the place.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Rothschild, and his new book, Going for Broke, is about Robert Campo and how he took over two huge chains of American department stores and ended up putting both of them into bankruptcy. Now, this takeover of Allied was the biggest hostile takeover of anything in the United States except for an oil company. How did he plan the hostile takeover?
Well, he wasn't even sure what a hostile takeover was. You know, when he came to New York, he was looking for investment banks after he decided Tribco Partner wasn't going to be big enough for him. And it was almost like dialing a bank. He was looking up in the Yellow Pages. You know, Drexel he could have gone to, first Boston. Actually, he didn't go to Drexel, but he was sort of dialing for dollars and wandering around. And the takeover strategy kind of developed on its own in lunchroom conversations. I mean, the essence of it is there was no strategy to begin with. And the bankers never thought this man could take over Allied Stores, but they decided to play along with him in the hope that somewhere down the line there might be a side deal. Maybe he'd buy a part of Allied. Maybe he'd buy the shopping centers that were initially introduced to him through Tribco Partner. But, you know, so the thing sort of gathered its own momentum. Most people, including Campo's own advisors, thought it was a crazy scheme. But then it gathered its own momentum, and ultimately he had the company.
Now, Campo financed the takeovers through junk bonds. Explain for us what that means.
Well, actually, he financed them through a combination of regular bank loans, secured loans, sort of similar to what we get when we buy a house and get a mortgage. And junk bonds, and essentially junk bonds are just bonds where there's very little security. There's no asset there if the company goes under that the bondholder will get. So a junk bond is just the riskiest form of lending. You know, if you and I went to our friends and said, you know, we'd like you to give us some money, we don't have any assets, but we think we can pay you back, that would be a junk bond.
And in return, the person loaning the money gets a high interest rate.
Right, a high interest rate for the risk. I mean, I guess it's sort of like Vigorish, I guess they used to call it, with the old loan sharks. I mean, I think the whole junk bond thing isn't far away from the days of street loan sharks.
Now, you write that the deal was also financed in part by paper in kind, PIK, which you describe as even junkier than junk bonds. And you say that the success of this deal revolutionized the pricing of deals.
Yes, it did. I mean, the financing got thinner and thinner, and at some point, you know, they weren't even satisfied that maybe the money wouldn't be paid later. It was they were paying paper with paper, and the idea in this PIK thing was that instead of getting actual cash for your loan, you would get more paper, and then sometime up the road, maybe in 10 years, you'd have amassed a lot of paper that would be supposedly worth something. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of like buying Confederate bills, but you know in advance that the Confederacy has lost the war. I mean, it's really a strange form of financing. But based on the fact that they could find greater fools to buy these bonds, you know, then they put a higher price on the companies that they were taking over.
Now, First Boston loaned Campo a lot of money for the takeover deal, but apparently they didn't do a very good check on him. What are some of the things they should have known about Robert Campo that they didn't find out about?
Well, one of the first things they should have known is that he, for a while, years earlier, had carried on a subterfuge with two families in Canada, where he had a wife and children in Ottawa, and then he had a mistress and children in Montreal, and he was vacillating back and forth, like some kind of landlubber's version of Captain's Paradise, if you remember that movie. I don't think that the bankers necessarily had to know that because people's romantic or sexual activities have to be known. But the funny thing about it is the way he handled this, it just got so complicated, and it was an exact replica of what happened when he got involved with the banks. So in that sense, I think they would have been well advised to have known about this. They quickly learned about his volatile temper because, you know, he abused all the bankers who lent him the money. He was not a very polite person. He would slam doors on them. He had a habit of calling them at 4:30 in the morning with new ideas for money they should be loaning him. And he was very imperious in his attitudes. And they did learn that and kept lending to him. So I guess the knowledge of what he was like as he revealed himself didn't deter them in the end.
He'd also had a couple of nervous breakdowns that were associated in part with other deals.
Yes, he would get very giddy and optimistic and sort of take himself, I think, and he worked very hard. You know, he sort of was one of those 20-hour-a-day people who would be calling all night on one deal or another. And he always had 10 side deals going for every deal. So I think he worked himself into exhaustion. And then great depressions would set in, and he'd have to go off and sort of take himself out of circulation for 6 months or a year to gather his energy. And these are also things that were known in Canada, but I don't think the bankers in the U.S. knew much about it at all.
Soon after Campo managed to buy Allied Stores, he wanted to buy another chain of departments, another conglomerate of department stores, Federated Stores, which included Bloomingdale's, Burdine's, Filene's, and a bunch of others. How soon after Allied did he want to buy Federated, and what for? I mean, he just bought this really big company of stores. What did he need another one for, especially so soon?
Well, I think it was part of that restless dare to be great energy that he had. You know, he had something really big, and then he thought, I'm even more important than this. I want something really, really big. And he used to say that Brooks Brothers was, you know, the love of his life and the one thing he'd always wanted. And then once he had it, he lost interest in it right away, and he wanted the next thing, which was Bloomingdale's. And he got quite enamored of Bloomingdale's, and it wasn't more than 6 months into Allied. And after all, here he is with $4 billion in loans, now running the major company. And he was running it himself for a time because he didn't get along with the management. The original idea was he would bring in a professional manager, and eventually he did that. But for a long period of time, he was sort of like George Steinbrenner. I mean, he was very involved in every aspect. He used to walk into the stores and tried to get the Brooks Brothers suits changed more to a European cut, which was more to his liking. And, you know, he sort of meddled in every aspect of the stores. But it wasn't long before he decided, it wasn't important enough. Bob Campo was bigger than Allied. Bob Campo wanted Federated. Bob Campo wanted the world. So off he was to buy another chain.
Now, did he have to dismantle part of Allied in order to finance buying Federated?
To a degree, although he had to dismantle Allied to finance Allied, the way these so-called leverage buyouts worked was that you would take a company. It was almost like stripping a car of its parts. You would take a company and you would sell off certain divisions and use that money to pay back some of the short-term debt that you had taken on to buy the company. And then you'd be left with a smaller company and supposedly a company that could handle its debt. So he had already sold off several divisions of Allied before he even thought about Federated. But then when Federated happened, he had to sell off more, and one of the ones he had to sell off was Brooks Brothers, which he'd told people again and again that he would never sell, was the love of his life and, you know, the most important thing that would ever happen to him. So, you know, here we had him running around trying to peddle Brooks Brothers.
See, I find it really interesting that an old establishment store like Brooks Brothers sort of suddenly become part of all these, like, new go-go money deals.
Well, I think that's what happened when all of these stores got, you know, they got brought into the department store conglomerates. The same thing happened with Rich's, which was an old family outfit in Atlanta, which became part of Federated in the mid-70s against the advice of one of the people in the Rich family, I'm aware of. But then once they were part of these big conglomerates, they were sort of, you know, they were targets. They were defenseless. The funny thing is that the boards of directors of these companies were really legally bound to sell the company once it was put, quote-unquote, into play, which is what they called this game of leverage buyout, so that they couldn't even refuse to sell it to somebody that they thought was going to run it into the ground.
Why not? Why couldn't they refuse?
Well, because since these were public companies, their mandate was to get the best value for the shareholders. And if once it seemed that the company was to be sold, then their only mission was to make sure that the shareholders got the most money for their stock. And you can see how a shareholder would be upset if instead of selling to Bob Campo, they'd sold, let's say, to somebody who knew something about retailing. Instead of giving him $73 a share or giving the shareholder $73 a share, they had sold it for $66. The shareholders would have been yelling and screaming, and there would have been lots of lawsuits. So in a way, once the thing got rolling, even though most people, I think, in this deal would rather not have sold to Bob Campo, they almost had no choice.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John Rothschild, author of the new book, Going for Broke, How Robert Campo Bankrupted the Retail Industry, Jolted the Junk Bond Market, and Brought the Booming 80s to a Crashing Halt. We're going to take a short break, then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. John Rothschild is my guest, and we're talking about Robert Campo, who took over two huge chains of department stores, which together included Bloomingdale's, Brooks Brothers, Ann Taylor, Filene's, and lots more. In September of 89, Campo had a cash crisis, and he hinted that he might miss a payment on the junk bonds. And you say that's when the junk bond market collapsed in sympathy. What happened, and what did it mean?
Well, actually, the junk bond market had been going down. It had already had a series of shocks. But this seemed to be the most shocking. You know, here was a major company that was about to default on its bonds, or that was intimating that it might not be able to pay. And for a day or two, apparently there were hardly any buyers or sellers in the entire junk bond market. And the value of the junk bonds in other enterprises fell in sympathy with the Campo bonds, because people began to see that, you know, maybe a lot of other companies wouldn't be paying on their junk bonds either. So it had a tremendous psychological effect on the whole market.
Now, both Allied and Federated department stores went into bankruptcy in January of 1990. Who are the big losers?
Well, I think the biggest losers were the small vendors, the people on 7th Avenue that manufactured dresses or blouses or swimsuits, who had sent merchandise in December, of 89, to all of the stores, thinking, as they always had, that they would be paid. And what happened once the bankruptcy occurred, you know, they weren't paid for their merchandise and still haven't been. So they were left holding the bag for many millions of dollars. And I think some of the smaller people had a very hard time coping with that. I talked to a couple of people who had to lay off. These are people who only employed 30 workers to begin with, but they might have to lay off five or six of them right away because they, you know, they hadn't been paid the money that they needed to keep in business. So vendors, number one, obviously junk bond holders, many of which were institutions who, you know, aren't getting paid the interest on their junk bonds. So I think off the bat, those are the two major groups of losers. And, of course, the big banks like Citicorp that put together the commercial lending syndicates that lent huge amounts, you know, and we see the problem with banking that we have today. And one of the reasons is that banks lent so much money to leverage buyouts. So those are three main areas, I guess, where people were hurt by it. And a lot of people were laid off in the two chains. I know in Miami they once had a pink slip party at one of the Jordan Marsh stores. And this is before the recession. Retailing was still doing fairly well. So many people lost their jobs also.
You know, it's the Christmas season. A lot of us are heading to the department stores to do Christmas shopping. What effect does the Campo deal and bankruptcy have on us shoppers now?
Well, I think you could say that retailing was having its troubles even without Campo, but I liken it to the airline industry, where a few of the companies who were in the worst shape had to discount their ticket prices, which forced all the other airline companies to do the same. And I think you find that in retailing, that especially in 89, this cycle of markdowns began to accelerate as the Campo stores, desperate for cash, had to lower the prices on all their goods so that people would buy them. And I think, you know, people now anticipate sales and, you know, won't buy anything unless it is marked down. And I think that that cycle was greatly accelerated by Campo.
So if we shop today at Bloomingdale's or Jordan Marsh or Filene's or any one of the number of stores that were involved in these Campo takeover deals, who owns them now?
Well, I guess the bankruptcy court owns them. The debtors own them. The company, the company still exists, but they are in bankruptcy. I think when you shop and you look at the low prices, you can sort of thank Bob Campo for some of that. But then if you've been laid off, or if you haven't been able to get a loan at the bank, you know, or if you can't afford what's there anyway because you don't have the money, in a way you can thank Bob Campo for that too. So you sort of you know, get a good deal on one side and a bad deal on the other.
What impact do you think that Campo's bankruptcies had on leveraged buyouts and hostile takeovers and, you know, the crazy economic financial dealings of the 80s?
Well, the big innovation in the Campo deal, and First Boston did this, I still wonder why it is they ever did this. They not only were the bridesmaids to this arrangement. Usually the investment bank would put together the deal and then take fees. But First Boston also put its own money into both Campo deals. And this was revolutionary, was to take their own corporate capital and put them into essentially one of these risky undertakings. And they did it first in Allied, and they did it again in Federated. And the idea was they would get their money back once the junk bonds were sold, and some of the proceeds would be used to repay them for their bridge loans, as these things were called. So the Campo deal also created a flood of these bridge loans, of other investment banks putting their own money into deals. Part of the reason they were doing this was to counteract Drexel Burnham Lambert's ability to raise huge amounts of money with Michael Milken. And so some of the regular investment banks started this idea of using their own money in deals. And there were several ancillary fiascos from that. So, you know, the Campo thing, I mean, if you had to pick one single takeover event in the 80s that had the most ramifications, I think this would be it.
So Campo started this practice of banks using their own money, but
yeah,
it also ended it too?
Exactly. It wasn't his idea. It was actually Bruce Wasserstein's idea, who was the great takeover wizard at First Boston, who took Campo on as a client. Then after Wasserstein did it with Allied, then, you know, the other investment banks wanted to copy him, and many others did it. So, it was the beginning of the end of that whole trend. I mean, between 1987 and 1990, many of those kinds of loans were made, but not anymore.
Do you see the story of Robert Campo as being bigger than the story of Campo himself?
Yeah, I think it's the story of a financial system gone wild. Bankers lending in all directions without really stopping to think what they're doing. I think it's a story of take fees now and don't worry about tomorrow. And I think it's a story that explains, as well as any other, the predicaments that we're in today.
The financial predicament.
Yeah. I think we'll be paying for this for a long time.
Well, John Rothschild, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay. Thanks, Terry.
John Rothschild is the author of the new book, Going for Broke, and it's about the Robert Campo takeovers of two big chains of department stores, how he bought them and how he made them bankrupt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.